So this is the digestive tract with the exposed surfaces. So you could see some of these hormones and where they come from, and we're going to go over a little bit about what they do. And some of you may already know this, and if you do, you're welcome to shout out when I ask for input. So we have the food that comes down and lands in the stomach, and it stimulates a hormone called gastrin. And gastrin's job is to stimulate HCl production. Who's not heard of HCl? Hydrochloric acid, it's stomach acid that helps us to begin the digestion of our proteins and minerals. Super important. People, it's more common to have low HCl in our society than it is to have excess HCl, even though you wouldn't believe it from all the proton pump inhibitor commercials that are on average TV shows, right? But really, it's more likely that people have low stomach acid, but it can manifest similarly. And actually, your homework assignment, I'm going to give it to you now so I don't forget to do that. Tonight is in the handout section. There's a bunch of assessments that you can take and you can use with your clients. Again, you have digital form, but I'd love you to fill them out for yourself, because there's a digestive assessment that goes through high stomach acid, low stomach acid, small intestine, pancreas, all the different pieces of this track, and gives you a score for each one. And it's really good to see. And then tomorrow we're going to be talking more about assessments. We'll go over those exams. And then on Sunday we'll be talking about protocols and things you can do to actually work with whatever comes up for your patient client. So it'd be really good if tonight you go through minimally the one that says digestion and has those different pieces. But there's also one that's for candida, a score for candida, and a score for leaky gut. And I should rename the one that says candida actually to dysbiosis, meaning just bad life in the gut. It could be candida overgrowth, it could be parasites, it could be a bacterial overgrowth, it could be viral, fungus, whatever. So do those tonight before you come in tomorrow and bring them in. That way when we're going over them, you'll have a sense from your own experience of your own body what they mean. So again, stomach acid, really important, but gastrin is the hormone that stimulates that. And then we have the beginning of the protein digestion, and then the food starts and makes its way down into the small intestine. What is that noise? Is that me? Oh, they're doing construction out in the hallway? Oh, they may have a band. Okay, maybe we'll have some entertainment. I will speak loudly. Can you hear me? Okay, good. I can't hear myself, that's why. Okay, so the food then goes into the duodenum, which is the top part of the small intestine, and there's another hormonal surge, right? So the food hitting there stimulates the release of hormones called CCK, which is cholecystokinin, and another one called secretin, and another one called GIP, gastric inhibitory protein. And the GIP says, okay, food's down here now. We don't need the stomach acid to keep producing. And it slows down the production. I suppose that one of the causes of excess stomach acid could be that the GIP is deficient and isn't giving that signal back and the stomach keeps producing. But so again, you know the mechanisms, you can start to kind of think about what might be causing it. The secretin, the GIP have the, that's what the GIP does. The CCK and the secretin have different roles. The cholecystokinin, CCK is what we usually call it, will stimulate the gallbladder and the liver, make more bile, release more bile. That way, well, we know this big bolus of food is here. And depending on how much fat is in that bolus of food, because there's detection mechanisms for it, will determine how much bile is going to be secreted. So one of the problems where people have poor fat digestion, do you know anybody that when they eat fats, they just like don't feel good? Anybody in this room, you just don't feel that great with fats. It could be, there's a lot of these different places where it could be breaking down. It could be the liver's not producing enough, or the gallbladder's not active enough, and it's just kind of static, and we'll talk about why that can happen, and it's not releasing enough. But it could also be a hormonal problem, where the CCK is not being triggered to cause that stimulation, okay? So then the secretin will stimulate the pancreas to produce its enzymes, lipase, amylase, protease, so to continue the breakdown of the protein and then to start the breakdown, or continue actually the breakdown of starch, because that actually begins in the mouth with the production of the salivary amylase. And then to assist with the bile, to assist the bile in getting the fat digested. So the bile emulsifies the fat, puts it into teeny little globules, and then the lipase breaks it down and puts it into the bloodstream as fatty acids. So it's this hormonal soup that's happening in your gut. And the next thing that happens is, let's see, what else? Did I miss anything? Yeah, so then everything goes into the jejunum, which is the absorptive surface, and then the jejunum absorbs all those pieces into the bloodstream. The jejunum is where the leaky gut happens. So if something's malfunctioning up here, let's see if I can do this. Oh, okay, there it is. If something's malfunctioning up here, whether it's in the stomach or the duodenum, whether it be enzyme production or hormonal, then the food's not going to be fully digested when it hits the jejunum. And then that not fully digested food is not, it's delicate lining. It's that, what Dr. Tom always talks about, the shag carpet, right? Nice shag carpet, and it's supposed to be digesting these foods. And when you spread it all out, it's like a tennis court or doubles tennis court. It's huge. And all of that is absorptive surface. But when you get a lot of things that are not supposed to be there, and you're also maybe eating foods that you're not supposed to be eating, or not chewing the foods enough so that there's enough digestive surface area for those enzymes to break the food down, then you cause irritation and aggravation. So add to that eating gluten, eating other foods you might be allergic to, caffeine, even though Mike Mutzel said it, he likes it for one reason, which helps with the burning of fat, it also thins the lining of the digestive tract. So it really, if used, it needs to be used in very light moderation, because it can thin that lining, that mucus protection lining. And alcohol can do the same. So combination of toxins in our environment, glyphosates in our GMO food, the pesticides, herbicides, all these things that are getting down into this delicate lining of the jejunum, and the gluten actually, like, oh, it just tears it apart. So you get this flat surface and big holes in between. And then we have leaky gut. And then the other piece, which we'll talk about in a little bit when we talk about the microbiome, it's all those endotoxins before that we talked about, and those are lipopolysaccharides, which tear holes in the lining. So we need to have all this intact, and then the communication with the brain, which we'll talk about tomorrow. We'll go into more details on leaky gut, leaky brain, and what the mechanisms there are. But all of this happens and it breaks down. And remember that, I can't remember who talked about it, whether it was Dr. O'Brien or Mike, I think it might have been Dr. O'Brien, talking about that the composition of the brain barrier is the same as the composition of the gut barrier. So now you have all these inflammatory cytokines circulating, damaging that brain barrier, and now you might have depression because you have disrupted microorganisms in the gut and leaky gut, and it could be any of these places. So, and if there's questions as you're going along, write your questions down. I'll stop at a couple of places throughout because I don't want to go too far if it's too much. But this chart pulls together some of the stuff that Mike was talking about, with some of the hormones, and I won't go through every single one in detail, but I want to point out a few. So we've got, he talked about leptin, and you can add to that leptin that it also, also suppresses the T regulatory cells as well. The main function of the leptin is to signal satiety. So it's not a gut hormone per se, but it has an effect in that it has an effect on your appetite. And then the ghrelin is actually released by the stomach. So when you start to get that, oh, I need more fuel, the ghrelin gets produced in the stomach. And on the one hand, people are like, oh, I'm hungry, I have to eat right away. But the thing about that happens, if you have some extra weight, it could be very useful, and you could share this with your clients, to wait a half an hour once they start to get hungry. You know, take some water, sip on some tea, do something other than eat, to keep that ghrelin going for about a half an hour seems to be a good optimal time, because what ghrelin does is it stimulates growth hormone production. Growth hormone's one of our friends, and we know that in weight loss, there's a lot of folks that are paying to get growth hormone injections. This is a cheap and easy way to get the growth hormone to increase is by letting the ghrelin build up a little bit. And that comes from the stomach. We've also got gastrin, which is the third one. We talked about that a little bit because that stimulates the hydrochloric acid. We talked about the CCK. We talked about the secretin. Peptide YY, mainly produced in the lower part of the small intestine, the ileum, and the colon itself. And that basically is another way of turning this all off. Like, okay, the food's reached down here, guys. Let's turn it all off. Now, I'm going to mention something else. Thank you. That's super important, is that when you eat, you know how we have peristalsis in this large intestine? It's like things start to move and you sometimes feel that. We have a peristalsis of sorts throughout the entire small intestine also. And it's called migrating motor complex. Thank you. It's called the migrating motor complex. Now, here's the thing about the migrating motor complex. That's what moves things along. It moves the food along. It helps to contract and move the food along, but it also moves the bacteria along. And so if the migrating motor complex is inhibited, then the bacteria that are coming in and that are supposed to just make their way down to the large intestine, like all this lactobacillus that you're taking and all these probiotics you're taking, they're supposed to make their way down to your large intestine and colonize. If the migrating motor complex isn't working real well, they get stuck. They get stuck in the small intestine. And shout out what that can cause. SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So we really want to take care of the peristalsis, the migrating motor complex. And again, going back to the hunger, you don't stimulate migrating motor complex when you're in the fed state. It starts a couple hours after, 2 to 3 hours after you finish eating. So that gives another bit of credence to the idea of not eating frequently. The idea of eating every 2 hours is an archaic belief, not based on science. And so this is another reason. Blood sugar is one reason, but this is another reason. It's because if not, then you have this stasis that happens, and then you don't get everything moving along. It can cause constipation, certainly. And we're going to talk a little bit about the vagus nerve in a bit, about how the vagus nerve, is, if it's inhibited, can just thwart that whole movement process and lead to some of these things we don't want, like constipation and SIBO and gallbladder stasis and whatnot. So it's really important. And then Mike talked about incretins. And we talked already about GIP, which is produced after the stomach leaves, the food leaves the stomach and into the duodenum. But the other one he kept mentioning, it was GLP-1. And does anybody know what GLP-1 is? Because he kept saying it over and over. It's glucagon-like peptide. And glucagon is like insulin's kissing cousin, right? Insulin helps to bring the blood sugar down. They're both pancreatic enzymes, hormones. It brings the blood sugar down, helps the sugar get transported into the cells. But then when the blood sugar starts to go a little bit low, there's a stimulation to release glucagon, which then takes the sugars from storage. Usually it goes to the liver and pulls out the buildup of starches in the liver that we store there, and takes it and puts it into the bloodstream. Well, this is a glucagon-like peptide, and what it does is it stimulates the release of insulin, and it acts kind of like glucagon, which is, in a way, it depresses the glucagon. It's like glucagon, because if you have an increase in glucagon into the bloodstream, the pancreas isn't going to produce it anymore. So it helps to increase the levels of insulin. Now, he talked about it in terms of using it as a drug for diabetes, these GLPs. And that raises a question for me of type 1 diabetes. It would make sense for, because we want to be able to stimulate more insulin. With type 2 early on, where people are actually in insulin resistance, is it really a good idea? Or is it just for late stage type 2 where the pancreas is starting to fail? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm just putting that out to you as a question, because as I think and I hear people speak about research and whatnot, my mind's going to how does it really work and how is that going to be, how's that going to affect? So the jury's out on that. I'm going to do some research to figure out, like, really, is it really being used for type 2, or is it more being used for type 2 diabetics in lieu of putting them on insulin, just get the body to make more? So I don't know the answer to that at this point. We have somatostatin, which inhibits gastrin, inhibits the CCK, basically inhibits everything as the food moves into the small intestine. Then we have two that you probably don't think about as gut hormones, but dopamine and serotonin. And dopamine and serotonin are neurotransmitters typically. We think about them as neurotransmitters produced in the brain, but really 90% of all the serotonin in the body is produced in the gut. And about 50 to 75%, I don't know the exact number, of the dopamine is produced in the gut. And they have an effect on gastric motility. So for dopamine, it reduces the motility and protects the mucosa. So if you're doing something that increases the dopamine too much, you can get constipation. So I start to think about some of the recreational drugs that people use to help keep the dopamine or increase dopamine, like marijuana. And I don't know for sure, but I would suspect that that might be decreased gastric motility, SIBO, some of those things might be a side effect. But again, I'm just thinking things through and going, I haven't seen research to that effect, but that's the thought process that I would have. Especially if you're dealing with somebody who's a habitual pot user and is saying, oh, I'm having all these gut problems, you want to be able to look back, because it does increase the dopamine in the brain. And then finally, serotonin, which inhibits the HCL and then stimulates the mucus, so the protective mucus. But again, if you have too much serotonin, if you're taking SSRIs and you're not at a right dose, or you have a client that is, then too much serotonin can inhibit stomach acid, right? So all of these things you have to take into a mind when you're doing history. And tomorrow we're going to talk about those types of questions you want to be asking people so you can get at what's exactly going on. So is this all making sense? Anybody, yes or no? Making sense? Good? Okay. So this other chart, and I just again gave you these for reference. Well, the next thing we're talking about is the brain, and then I have two more charts. So the brain has hormones too. We don't think of the brain as an endocrine gland, but right, there's the hypothalamus, there's the pituitary, and they produce a whole bunch of hormones. They're not all gut related, but there's definitely hormones related to the brain. And I just wanted to tie that in. So that's the pituitary, hypothalamic pituitary axis. So we're going to look at some of those hormones that are produced in the brain. Again, I'm not going through detail. I gave you this for reference. Last year's Shine, we went through this in detail because that was on the HPAT axis, which is hypothalamic pituitary adrenal thyroid axis. Those of you who are in any PT, you have access to that if you weren't there, so you can go back and look at it. And many of you got, as a bonus for signing up early for this, you got those videos. So if you really want to really dig in to the hypothalamus, the pituitary, the thyroid, the adrenals, that's a great place to look. So, you know, you've probably heard of most of these, but the hypothalamus is a stimulator. It does stimulation. So it stimulates the pituitary to talk to the thyroid. So it's not stimulate, releasing factors. So it talks to the pituitary and tells the pituitary, hey, we need more thyroid hormone. Hey, we need more adrenal hormone. Hey, we need more. So that's mostly what it does. In addition, it makes growth hormone, but it doesn't secrete growth hormone. The pituitary actually does the secretion of that. And then the pituitary stimulates. It just talks to. It's like the doer. It's like the slave driver. Okay, thyroid, we need you to make more thyroid hormone. Okay, adrenals, we're under stress here. There's a tiger chasing us. Make more adrenal hormones, et cetera, et cetera. And same thing with reproductive hormones like follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. So the gut and the brain talk to each other. It was really clear from Dr. O'Brien's talk this afternoon how much they talk to each other and how much the microbiome in the gut talks to the brain. So let's just look at what are some of the ways that the gut and the brain communicate. Well, one is the vagus nerve, and we'll go into a little bit more detail about the vagus nerve, what it does, how to stimulate it, and what happens when it's underactive. It's part of what's called the parasympathetic nervous system, which we just got into with doing breathing, with doing heart math. And it's really important for you to teach your clients how to get into parasympathetic mode as much as possible. And our lives are not parasympathetic, right? They're sympathetic all day long. It's the traffic, it's the deadlines, it's that. But you can bring yourself back to parasympathetic over and over and over again. And after a while, your body actually learns how to do it. I mean, naturally, but it does take practice. And it's something that if you are working with people, just working on the nutrition isn't going to do the trick. You've got to teach them to get into parasympathetic nervous system mode. The yoga, the qigong, movement, acupuncture, massage. But heart math is my favorite because it's portable. And I can do it in 30-second increments throughout the day. And yoga's great, but it takes a little time and changing into yoga clothes. Meditation's awesome, takes some time. Tai Chi is great. They're all beautiful and get the people to do it. But it's also important, even if they're doing those things, to do something to get into parasympathetic, to stimulate that vagus nerve throughout the day that they can just keep doing. Because I've known yoga teachers who are awesome when they're doing yoga and they're stress bunnies the whole rest of the time. Do you know anybody like that? Yeah? It's like, oh, okay, let's breathe. I get all like agitated just listening. I just go, okay, breathe. Let's take some breaths. So the more you can do this, the better. And remember earlier, Mike talked about the pre-meal ritual. We should all do that before we eat, except everybody starts eating at a different time. But really, just sit there and shift so that you can turn on your digestive tract, because the vagus nerve, as we'll see in a bit, I'll show you where it goes and what it does, is so important to get stimulated before you have a meal. Okay? Does that make sense? Everybody agree to do that? I teach this heart math technique. I teach this pre-meal ritual. And when people are going, well, I'm doing all the herbs and I'm taking glutamine and I'm taking DGL and I'm doing all this stuff to heal my gut, but I still have problems. Like, are you doing the pre-meal ritual? Are you breathing? Are you chewing your food? What, how many times are we supposed to chew it? 42 times? Hard. I tried it at lunch. I'm like, okay. So that's why I blend a lot of my food. And you blend it, but you keep it in your mouth and you hold it there. Anyway, it's good stuff. And we all need to do it more, right? We need to be in parasympathetic to digest well. Okay, so what else? We have the vagus nerve. We have the stimulation, you know, via neurotransmitters. We have neurotransmitters that live in the brain that affect the gut. We also have those same neurotransmitters that are living in the gut and affect the brain. We've got, well, how does leaky gut talk to the brain? Anybody? How does leaky gut affect the brain? Lets in toxins that can be neurotoxic, and technically the brain shouldn't allow those toxins in, but the leaky gut leads to inflammatory cytokines, which then affect the blood-brain barrier, and next thing you know, we're letting these toxins in. What's the other way that Dr. O'Brien talked about earlier? Antibodies, and he talked about cross-reactivity or molecular mimicry. Right? Where some of the antibodies to gluten or to whatever other foods are getting into your bloodstream, they're attacking the cerebellum or the Purkinje cells or other parts of the brain. So leaky gut has profound, and we'll talk more about leaky gut, leaky brain tomorrow. Allergens, we talked about that. The microbiome, there have been found these two specific species that have had a lot of studies. It doesn't mean that there are no other species that have those effects on the brain, but these in particular have been found to produce GABA, which is a calming neurotransmitter. And that was the Lactobacillus helveticus and Bifidobacterium longum. I'm sure there's others. And tomorrow morning, late morning, right before lunch, Steph Jackson's going to be talking about that whole microbiome diversity and how everybody's a little bit different and how you as a practitioner can learn to just not just give somebody this random, okay, take this 12-strain one, okay, take this 6-strain one, figure out what they might really need and what might do them good. Remember, Mike talked about all the different, like Lactobacillus acidophilus, you look at the numbers after, there's a lot of different ones. And it can be overwhelming, there's like thousands of different species, but there's certain ones that are relatively easy to manipulate and get into the diet and get into probiotic foods and custom probiotics, like actually making your sauerkraut and teaching people how to customize their sauerkraut with the right organisms for them. And that's just a tease for what Steph's going to talk about tomorrow. We have inflammation, right? Cytokines, inflammatory cytokines are just chemicals. They're part of the immune system that cause inflammation. Now they affect the gut, but they also affect the brain. And when you've got part of your brain that's swollen or inflamed, what does that do to your thought process? Yeah, slows it down. Right, right. Absolutely, absolutely. And then there's the effects of all of that on mood, memory, and focus. All of that affects mood, memory, and focus. So, what's next? This was my version of that pre-meal ritual. Before you eat, just stop. Look at the food. Appreciate the beautiful color, the diversity. And then just pay attention, have gratitude. Like our old grace before meals that my family always made sure we did before every meal. But it was like, bless me, Father, bless me, Father, thank you for the food. Like, okay, that's a little, we can improve on that, let's just say. We can improve on that a little bit. But the concept is there. It's an age-old ritual. We just have to pull it in and not just do lip service to it, right? And when you look at the colors, Mike talked a lot about the colors, right? All those beautiful antioxidants and the way all that color affects the body, the gut microbiome, that's something you can just sit there and like, wow, it's a rainbow. I can really appreciate this food. And then it's the diversity of the food, right? What color is the food in the standard American diet? How many colors are there? White, brown, beige, right? There's not a whole lot of color. And it's the color that's giving us all those great fibers that help grow the good microbiome. Did somebody say something else? So reds and the greens and the purples and yellows, oranges, eating that rainbow is providing a diversity. So you take the time with your patients, your clients, to put that in. And I love, you know, the whole functional medicine concept of really looking at the function. And then if we marry that with actually teaching people how to do the food, not just saying, well, here's your diet, like Tom said before, well, here's your diet, just go do it. Like, how many people think that their clients would respond to that? Here's your diet, let's just go do it, see ya, call me if you have problems, right? We need to guide them through. We need to step by step. I do a lot of videos. I do a monthly call, and who's been on my monthly show that I do in the kitchen? So I go into my kitchen. Okay, I'd love to teach you how to do that because you need to get out there to more people. Just have fun in your kitchen, set up a camera. It's really not that hard to do. And you can teach people. You can make videos. You do it, Laura. And you can have it in your office. You can have it at your home. You can invite people in or you could do it over the internet. But teach them how to do it. Give them recipes. Give them menu plans. Even if you don't like making up recipes, find other people's. Get permission to use them or modify them or sell somebody else's book to them. But there's so much that people can do and they need that instruction. When I first started in practice, I was like, oh, wow, you need this, you need this. And I'd give them this 3-page list of all the things that were wrong and all the things they could do. And they would just glaze over and they didn't come back because they were overwhelmed. But now I don't do that. I work step by step. I tune into what that person needs. What do they need first? What are they most likely to do first? That's going to give them some effect. That's going to say, oh, look, I had some improvement. I remember I had a conversation with someone who I just started to work with, and she was really clean, pretty clean in her diet. You're going to see that. Oh, they're eating organic. They're eating whole foods. But she says, well, I only have gluten once a week with my husband. You know, we have this pizza, maybe a couple of times a week. We have this pizza, it's whole grain, it doesn't have cheese, it has all these veggies. Really, do I have to give it up? I said, give it up for a month, please. Just give it up for a month, let's see. Her brain fog cleared, her headaches cleared. She sat down and she actually wrote 3 chapters of a book she'd started years ago but couldn't get anywhere through. She wrote 3 chapters in one. She's like, whoa. And then guess what? She decided to do what? Test it, right? We try to test it. just, I can't believe that that was it. It must be a coincidence. So her husband says, let's get the pizza. She goes, no, on this gluten-free. Ah, what the heck? I'll give it a try. It can't hurt. So she eats the pizza. Within an hour, her brain fog came back and all she wanted to do was sleep. It can happen that, especially when you're away from it for a length of time, you're so much more sensitized to it. So like Dr. O'Brien was saying today, don't like go by, like, I don't have a problem. My husband always tells me that. I don't have a problem with gluten. I eat gluten. I don't get, you know, gassy or bloated. I'm like, what's happening to your brain? Notice what's happening to your brain. Notice how you feel. He's got antibodies. We've tested him. He's getting better. It's hard to not get better when you're around me all the time. I'm not exactly subtle, let's just say. You're going to eat what? Not bringing that into my house. So, and this is, again, repeat of what Dr. O'Brien said this afternoon. The human body is mostly non-human, right? We've got, 50 trillion human cells and 500 trillion bug cells, other cells, right? Huge. We are not mostly human. And the same thing with the genes, when we look at our genes. So we'll look at that in a moment. What I want to show you is when we talk microbiome, it might be confusing because we talk microbiome, we're thinking gut. But the microbiome is all over. It's the critters that live in all of our orifices. They're in the nose, they're in the ears, they're in the mouth, they're in the vagina, they're in the urinary tract, they're in the gut, they're on the skin. And we have different types of organisms, and we'll talk about what those are in a bit. Some of them are good. Some of them are neutral most of the time, and then they can go bad, and some of them are bad. So what's some of the deals, right? So we have, that's a factor of 10 to 1. We've already talked about that in terms of the cells. We've got, okay, so the genes, the total number of genes associated with our microbiome is 100 to 1. Not 10 to 1, 100 to 1. Their genes outnumber ours 100 to 1. Their cells outnumber ours 10 to 1. Their genes outnumber us 100 to 1. And they contribute more genes responsible for our survival than we do. So we need to take care of them, right? Antibacterial soap. Who has clients that are using that stuff, right? Or using when they go to the supermarket now, we're really so germ-phobic, we have those little wipe things with the antimicrobial soap. You know, we're wiping away all the good stuff, right? Good old soap and water is good enough. You don't have to just strip of everything. There are circumstances maybe when somebody's immune compromised, but we're just creating these superbugs by using all these antimicrobial soaps. And there's antibiotics in the food supply, right? The dairy, the meat, the eggs. If that those animals aren't raised organically and, you know, pasture fed, they're loaded with antibiotics which get into your system and they're disrupting our own microbiome. So let's look at, what exactly do we mean by the gut microbiome? We think about, you know, at first hear the word microbiome, we're thinking the organisms that live in our gut. But the microbiome is actually describing the genetics of the organisms that live in the gut. And there was a whole microbiome project. This is just a picture. We're not going to go over that in detail. We're not going to study it. We're not going to have a test on it. But that just shows you the different bacteria and how they are in the different parts of the body. That's a lot of spaces. And look, it's different in the elbow crease than it is in the back of the knee. And it's different there than on the hands. Right? There's a ton of these. And if we get them out of balance, you know, a lot of people come in with rashes and strep and staph infections that are chronic. Well, we're wiping out their good protective bacteria. And that's something that you need to be helping people to stop doing. What is this? This is supposed to be all together. Okay, so the next thing we're going to talk about is the microbiome of the gut. Like, what are they? So we have three categories. We have the beneficial, we have the opportunistic, or sometimes called the commensal, and we have the pathogenic. The beneficial, obviously, are the ones that do good stuff, and we'll talk about what they do for us in a moment. The opportunistic or commensal, they're just neutral, they're there, until we start to create an imbalance. You take antibiotics, these commensals are suddenly, oh, well, there's all this room to grow. We're going to grow out of control, and they take over. Okay, and then we have the obvious pathogenic, like they don't belong in there at all. We do have small amounts of some of these pathogenics, very tiny amounts, but it usually those guys are the ones that are going to actually make everyone sick. Giardia lambia, for example, right? You go and you drink water out of a stream, or some of those bacteria that live in various, you know, polluted waters, etc. So what do they do for us? Well, let's talk about before that. Let's talk about how our body keeps the foreign ones, anything that's foreign, from hurting us, right? We have a stomach acid, remember? So we have acidic pH to try to kill them off there. And what happens if people have low stomach acid, or they're taking Tums or, you know, Nexium or Prilosec or some of those proton pump inhibitors to reduce the stomach acid? We're reducing some of the immune defense that stomach acid provides for us. We've also got the bile. The bile is a good thing, but a lot of people their gallbladders become sluggish. And some of that comes from the vagus nerve not being innervated properly, from eating too frequently and not having good movement between, from maybe some of the hormones, maybe the lining of the gut is irritated in the duodenum and it's not producing the CCK to stimulate the bile production. A lot of things could cause that. And then, of course, the immune system. So once it gets through the exterior, it gets inside, the immune system's going to attack. Now, the immune system it's all over. But the gut is actually, one of its functions is to protect the inside world from the outside world. Because the gut is really not inside of our bodies. Who knew that? Yeah? Yeah. So the gut is actually a tube that runs from mouth to anus. But it's not in. It's through. Right? And the lining, those villi, and all the immune system components that live in those cells, the enterocytes that line it, those guys are protecting the outside world from coming in. So whether it's microbes or whether it's toxins, you know, pesticides, herbicides, large things, it's protecting. And when that immune barrier breaks down, like in leaky gut, everything goes haywire. And that's where some of the brain stuff comes in, because all that stuff gets into the bloodstream. So what are they supposed to do? Well, they're supposed to help us with digestion, help us with breaking down the food, making B vitamins, right? B12 is made by intestinal bacteria, except most people don't get enough of that bacteria in them that make the B12 anymore, because we're rinsing and washing our foods like crazy, right? And spray the food grade hydrogen peroxide on the food when you pick it from the ground. So we don't get all those good organisms to help make some of these B vitamins. So we need to take more of them or eat foods that are more concentrated in them. Vitamin K is an important one that's produced by the intestinal bacteria. What else do we have? Making neurotransmitters. We talked about some of those gut bugs that actually make GABA and that make dopamine and make serotonin. So all of these things are functions. The other thing is, and Mike talked a little bit about this, short chain fatty acids. So we take the undigestible fibers that are in the foods. If we're eating the foods, if we eat a lunch like today, which is a lot of that fiber in there, that's food for those bacteria to produce short chain fatty acids. So he talked about, you can get some of these in food, like butyrate you can get in butter. But if you've got the right bacteria, if you've got enough of the the bifidus bacteria, they make your short-chain fatty acids. They make the butyrate. They know how to ferment the carbohydrate and make the butyrate. So these short-chain fatty acids are very helpful for protecting the lining of the gut. Oh, I didn't put it up. There's others, and you can see this when we look tomorrow. We're going to look at the stool tests and the results of stool tests, that you can measure these and see how much butyrate do they have, how much propionate do they have, how much acetate do they have. And it's all different, right? If everybody was the same, we could just say, well, here's we go. We just create this particular fermented food, this particular set of probiotics, and everybody's the same. But this is just taking two different people and looking at the breakdown, and each one of those are different species. They're just similar to what Mike showed earlier, where it's different species of bacteria. And it's very different from one person to the next. So if it gets disrupted and you think that you can just take one formula and give it to them, you can get in trouble, right? You're not necessarily going to fix the problem. So you heard him talk earlier about Firmicutes and Bacteroides. So Bacteroides, Firmicutes. Who wants Firmicutes? No? Not really? Doesn't that look like where you want to be? No? Okay, Bacteroides. Okay? You want the Firmicutes? You can get transplants from other people and get their Firmicutes, right? So they've even done studies where you take someone who's obese and you do a fecal transplant. Have anybody not heard of fecal transplants? They're doing them a lot, where they basically take the stool from one person, a healthy person hopefully, and transplant it into someone who's not so healthy. Well, when they did these studies and they took the stool from a person who was lean, like this guy on the right, I left, you're right. When they took stool from that guy and put him into this guy started to lose weight. Okay, so how do we get more Bacteroides? More Bacteroides, right? We with the way we eat, with eating a lot of high fiber, very colorful foods, and the Bifidobacter. And when I do stool tests on people, and I do them a fair amount of the time, the thing I see low mostly is the Bifido. They're usually real good on the lactobacillus because most of the formulas people are taking are really high in the various lactobacillus strains, but not that high in the bifidus. And a lot of people are not eating the amount of fiber that they need to be eating to get that. So this is something to look at in people that come in and say, I'm not eating all that much and I'm exercising. Why am I not losing this gut? Well, let's take a look. Let's take a look at your stool. Let's see what the balance is. And then you try to shift it. I'm not a big fan of just jumping in and doing tests right away, and I'll share with you my methodology tomorrow just because a lot of times it's just a matter of cleaning up their diet. But when somebody comes in and they've been to this and that and the other thing and they're eating really well, it's like, okay, let's just do some tests because we want to get to the heart of what's going on. But if you take, some truck driver who stops at the truck stops all day long and he's drinking Cokes and eating hot dogs and comes in and says, oh, I'm feeling this and I'm feeling that. You're like, you run a battery of tests on him. You're wasting his money and your time and his time. You might as well just clean up his diet first. Now, you will have those folks that say, I don't believe you, right? I don't believe you. Prove it. Okay. Then you run the tests. You say, well, it's going to cost you to run the test. You could either listen to me and shift your diet and the way you're eating and do the breathing before eating, or we can spend a lot of money and the tests are going to tell you to do the same thing. Your choice. But some people won't. I mean, I had one person, I said, I think you're gluten intolerant. Yeah, I'm mostly gluten-free. Mostly gluten-free. I only eat it maybe once. Well, I don't eat it deliberately, but I don't ask when I go to restaurants. I said, well, you're getting gluten all the time if you don't ask when you go to restaurants because they'll put flour in the rice and all kinds of crazy stuff. So she says, I said, okay, is it going to take the test to actually prove it to you, or do you need to, okay, let's do the test. Well, she did the test. It showed up she was gluten intolerant. She got really strict about it. All of her menopausal symptoms went away. And then she went, I wonder if my son's asthma has anything to do with this. I wonder if my daughter's eczema has anything to do with this. So she went and tested them. They showed up intolerant to gluten, cleaned it up, and now she is a health coach. What does she do? She teaches people how to go gluten-free. Awesome. So it's not just, did I miss one? No, I didn't. Okay. It's not just the sugars. They've been finding that some of the artificial sweeteners, like aspartame and some of those, sucralose, they actually are stimulating the gut bugs too. So when people say, no, I don't eat sugar. Can I have aspartame and sucralose on my anti-candida diet? What are you going to say? And this is, it evolves, right? We don't have the same microbiome now that we did at birth. And when we're born, it depends on, the gut bacteria that we get, depends on whether you were cesarean born or went through vaginal tract. And it's been found that if you are cesarean, the bugs that just kind of grow in and on you are whatever happened to be in the room and the doctor that delivered you or whatever. And so that's like pretty scary, right? Wouldn't we want to have the mom's vaginal tract, assuming mom's healthy and we can support her through her pregnancy, to have a good healthy colony there to inoculate the baby, right? That's what we want. So, you know, there's a lot of cesareans done these days, and some of them are for emergency, but I would say that majority of them are for convenience, right? Either doctor doesn't know that you can have a second baby vaginally after cesarean birth, and they're not willing to take the time. Or, you know, it's like, oh, you know, you're a little bit late. Let's just cut you open and get baby out. Or there's a lot of reasons. And there are emergency reasons, obviously. When I was, a long time ago, I met this gynecologist, and he was like, I was having a conversation with him. He's an OBGYN. And he was going, I said, how are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm bummed. I had to do a C-section today. I'm like, really? Because, you know, it was my second one this year. It was September. And I'm like, well, that's pretty good compared to the average, isn't it? He goes, yeah, but I like to avoid it. But mom was this. She was preeclampsic. She was, you know, he goes, I had to, but I don't like to. I don't want to. I want to see these babies just come through and naturally and have mom push. And he said a lot of times he gets into the situation where mom's been pushing for a long time and he knows she can do it. And the nurses are pressuring him to do a C-section. He's like, no, she can do this. She can do this. And he supports her and helps her do that. So there are really great OBGYNs out there that support that. And we need to just say, yay, hooray. But a lot of them are just like, they don't know. They're not educating themselves about this. And it's a lot more time to spend with somebody and really help them through their labor, which is why I think midwives are great, or doulas, even if you are having a birth with a doctor, to have that midwife or the doula along there to support through that whole process and help calm somebody down. It's like first baby, it's 12 hours. What's going to happen? Is my baby going to die? They're going to be, you know, mama gets freaked out. And if they have that really supportive, nurturing person there. Anybody here a doula or a midwife? You were? Cool. It's a great, I once thought about it. I've assisted at several births. There were people that were patients of mine, and they asked me to be there, and it was just such an amazing experience. And I was doing acupressure on them, I had one birth where we had brought needles in, and it was stalled, and they were threatening to do Pitocin to stimulate. And so we had four people, her husband, a good friend who was sitting in for her mom, and her doula, and me. And I'm like, okay, we stuck needles in four different spots. I'm like, okay, one, two, three, let's twirl. Okay, now again, twirl. And the nurse walked in and went, walked right out. But she never had to have the Pitocin because it helped her naturally to stimulate it. And that's the kind of thing that's available. I don't know how we got off on a track. But we're born and we have certain bacteria, right? If we're vaginal delivery, we have these really nice lactobacillus species that come through. But with C-section, they're finding staphylococcus, corinthiobacteria, propionum bacterium. Those are not really healthy ways to get the world started. And as they age, assuming you're feeding the kid good fiber that they can then make this stuff, and breastfeeding so they can transfer some of the mom's protective factors, they can start to grow that. But that, you know, babies that are born by C-section tend to have more infections, tend to have more imbalances, more gut stuff than babies that were vaginally delivered. I mean, of course, you can make up for it. You take a baby that was C-section and you put them on a really great diet with lots of probiotics and lots of fiber and rainbow foods, and compare that to a C-section baby who is then put on formula and, you know, fed the standard American diet. Obviously, that C-section baby is going to fare better. So regardless of where people started, you can help them to make a difference. You can. Like, I think it was, I can't remember whether it was Tom or Mike that talked about earlier about the genes being, I think it was 30%. I've seen it's more like the genes are 10%. environment is, and we'll talk about epigenetics tomorrow and all the ways that you can modify. We're going to look at genes, we're going to look at SNPs, which are single nucleotide polymorphisms that some people have, but we're going to look at how the epigenetic alteration of that with diet, with attitude, with yoga, with meditation, with movement, all of that stuff, and that's all the stuff that we know how to do to help people. It's really awesome. So this is just, you know, a chart for you. We don't need to go into all of that in detail. We'd be here all day. But there's something called the Human Microbiome Project. There's also the Genome Project, and we'll talk a little bit about that one tomorrow. But the Microbiome Project, they set out to determine, like, what's a reference set of what these genomes of the good set of flora is, and then to characterize it. Like, what is that? And then explore how are changes in the environment affecting the microbiome, and then develop technologies and to actually analyze this. So they have it, and there's this company called Ubiome, I think Steph might talk about it a little bit more tomorrow, that actually runs the entire, you know, micro, lots of stuff. They'll tell you what's in your gut on a genomic basis. So they will really map out your microbiome. Now, some of them we have no idea what they do or whether they're valuable or invaluable, but some of them we do. So it can be a very valuable tool. The only downside of that test is it takes like 4 to 6 weeks to get it done. Because more people are doing it. Yeah. Yeah. So it takes a long time, but you can map it out with someone, and it's not expensive. It's like, what, $99? Because it's research. Not species specific. So the higher level, phylas and whatever. Is that what you mean? You have Helicobacter. Okay, got it. Got it. Okay. So it's somewhat useful, but not 100%. So those are some of the reasons that they did it. And what they did was they took, it wasn't that big a study to start. It was only 242 healthy volunteers from the U.S. And we know that that microbiome is going to be different from one country to the other, one continent to the other, and from males to females age range. A lot of things were going to affect it. But they just basically looked at 5,000 samples collected from all the different orifices, and they were testing them by specific kind of ribosomal RNA testing, and they identified more than 10,000 species living in our guts. In our bodies, the microbiome, 10,000. That's a lot of different kinds of critters, aren't there? And we don't, you know which ones are, we know already some of them that are pathogenic, some of them that are beneficial, but there's a lot that we just don't know. And Steph will talk more about that specificity tomorrow. So, but the thing is that it's not static. It's like, oh, you're exposed to some kind of disease, or oh, you're under certain stress, or different things happen, you go traveling. It's going to change that microbiome. But what they did find was that eventually it comes back to equilibrium. So it comes back and becomes normal. Okay. So we've talked about the microbiome. We've looked at gut hormones and the interaction with the brain. The next thing we're going to do is look at the enteric nervous system. And that's basically the second brain. We have this lining the gut all throughout our neurons that are picking up the signals of what's going on and transmitting them up through the vagus nerve to the brain to determine what behavior, what action is going to be taken as a result. And as Dr. O'Brien said earlier, more goes up than comes down, right? So we think about the brain controls everything, right? Signal from the brain down to the gut, it tells it what to do, but there's more signals from the gut telling the brain what's going on down there. And then the brain can react. It can activate the immune system. Like, oh, there's somebody crying across and there's somebody that's pathogenic. And it gives that signal back up there. So it's a really amazing body of neurons. Cravings. Who here has ever had cravings for certain foods under stress? The enteric nervous system and the microbiome are at the heart of that. It's like, okay, I just need chocolate. It's not you, it's your critters. Your critters want the chocolate. So the enteric nervous system can work in conjunction with the brain or independently. I mean, it can actually release neuropeptides. There's a lot of different neuropeptides that have been identified in the brain. Serotonin, dopamine, GABA, benzodiazepines, which are, we think about those as drugs that people are given, but there's actually natural benzodiazepines that are created. And all of these are neurochemicals that affect the brain. And they've all been found to be produced in the gut. It's pretty fascinating. So there's your brain. Everybody's seen this, but there's different lobes. There's the frontal lobe. We have the prefrontal cortex, which is that high-level thinking part of the brain. We have that primitive part in the back. And we have the cerebellum, which is responsible for balance. And all of these pieces are affected. So we're going to look at the vagus nerve. So I just give you the overview, and then that's the underside. And the vagus nerve comes out right over here. And it's part of the cranial nerve system. There's 12 cranial nerves. The vagus nerve is cranial nerve 10. And it's part of the parasympathetic branch. It's controlled by the parasympathetic branch of the nervous system. So let's talk about that. We have the autonomic nervous system. That's the stuff we don't control consciously. Like if I want to move my arm, that's not the autonomic nervous system. If I want my heart to beat, that's the autonomic nervous system, and I don't have to control it. Thank you very much, because I don't have to remember how to control it. Like people get like, which way do I do that? How do I do this? Your heart beats, your lungs breathe, your brain works, your digestion works, all automatically. There's two branches: the sympathetic branch, which is the fight flight branch, and there's the parasympathetic branch, which is often called the rest and digest branch. And we need balance between them. We need both of them. But in our world, which one do we think gets control more? Sympathetic, right? Because there's tigers chasing us 24/7. The traffic, the boss, the finances, the kid dropping out of high school, the mother that's sick and fell and broke her hip, and all of these things that come in as stressors. We get into that sympathetic dominant a lot. And what one of the things that happens when we're in that sympathetic dominant mode is that digestion is not something that's given priority, running and jumping. So all of the blood supply and all of the activity is shunted towards those extremities so you can run and jump and hide. The prefrontal cortex, which is where all the high-level thinking happens, we don't need that to run away from a tiger. We need the primitive lizard brain that knows how to run and jump and get out of the way. So we give control to the lizard brain. We take it away from the wizard brain. Now, how does that fare when the stress, the tiger, is not a tiger, but it's a math test? Like these kids going in to take math tests, and they go into fight-flight mode, which most of them do. I got to pass this, and there's so much stress and pressure put on these kids at school that they don't go in and go, oh, well, I have a test today. I got it. I aced it. I'm going to breathe. Now, HeartMath goes into the schools and teaches that technique to kids, and it's amazing, test-taking skills. But you go in, and you're in fight-flight mode. Which part of your brain gets control? I got to get out of here. I can't stand it. I got to go to the bathroom. I don't know the answers. Whereas if you can get into parasympathetic and you can get calm and you can get access to that prefrontal cortex, you can ace it. And I had an example of this once years ago when I decided to go back to school for acupuncture. And I did it at a time in my life when I shouldn't have done it. But I had two kids, young kids, like 10 and 6, and a husband who traveled most of the time, and a practice. And I was homeschooling. Is that enough? Should I have done something else? So I was doing all that, and I had to take a test. So I'd stayed up real late. I had my kids in 2 days a week. I had them in a homeschool co-op thing. So those are my 2 days I'd go to school. And I went to school, and I'm like, I haven't studied enough. Where am I going to have time to study enough? But I went through the material at least once, and I just said, you know what? I have perfect it's all in there, right? It's all in there. I'm going to have perfect access. So I did my heart math. I said, I'm just going to have perfect recall. And I did it calmly, and I just thought, and I got 100 on that test. Whoa, it works. It works because you can get yourself in that frame. And the Institute of Heart Math, if you go to their site, they have a whole set of resources for kids and for going into schools and teaching kids stuff. So really good stuff. So that's the vagus nerve. So let's look at it in more detail. This is what it controls, okay? So it controls the PNS, right? The parasympathetic nervous system. And so where is most of it going? Anybody want to shout that out? Where do most of those branches from that go? The gut. It controls every part of the gut. It controls the release of digestive enzymes, the release of stomach acid, the hormones in the gut. It controls heart, and it controls lungs. So it's a big, major thing. And if we have an inhibited parasympathetic system, if we have an inhibited vagus nerve, it's going to affect us in a lot of ways. Do you ever hear vasovagal syncope, where people faint? That's related to overstimulation of the vagus nerve. So there's a picture. And that's, again, for your reference. I, you know, pulled this out of a textbook, I think. And it's basically, you can see where the parasympathetic goes and where the sympathetic goes. So if you look at the parasympathetic, which is over on, did I get it right? The left? It affects the heart. It constricts the bronchi. It stimulates the digestive activity, stimulates the gallbladder, contracts the bladder. I mean, there's so much that it's doing. The sympathetic, what does it do? It gets you ready to fight and flight. It dilates your pupils so you can see more. It helps to inhibit salivation because you're not going to be digesting. So you need the salivation to be able to digest well, right? So if you're in that mode, you're going to have heart racing, right? You're going to have inhibited digestive activity. You're going to have lower stomach acid, lower digestive function, and constipation, right? Because it inhibits the motility. So all of these things happen when we go into that mode. So which is why I really want you to learn this technique or some technique like the heart math, where you can teach people to bring themselves back, to notice when they're gone and bring themselves back. So let's look at the vagus nerve. Okay, that's a close-up of it, where it comes out and what some of its functions are and how we can help it. So we already talked about the functions being what? What's one thing that it does? Heart. Okay, I heard heart. Breath, lungs. What else? Digestion. Okay, so those are the three main functions. And what happens if it's overactive? You faint, right? Causes a drop in blood pressure and you faint. What happens if it's underactive? Constipation, gastroparesis, which is like the stomach motility stops and things just like they eat food and it doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't empty, the emptying of the stomach doesn't happen. What else? They could have a hard time swallowing, right? Because it controls the swallowing mechanism. They have decreased enzyme production. They have loss of the gag reflex. That's controlled by the vagus nerve as well. And we're going to use that to show you how to stimulate the vagus nerve. It even can cause voice changes. So it affects the larynx. So it can affect voice changes. So if somebody says, you know, it's weird, my voice is changing. Suspect vagus nerve. Oh, do you also have constipation or you have sluggish bowels or what about, you know, digestion? They're going, what? What does my voice have to do with my bowels? A lot. So let's look specifically at, did I get these out of order? I'm missing one. Okay, no, there it is. All right, so let's look at what happens if the vagus nerve is underactive. We talked about some of these earlier. We talked about SIBO, right, because it's affecting the motility. We talked about constipation. It affects the gallbladder. Gallbladder isn't going to contract as much. You can end up with gallstones as a result. It affects the stomach, so we can have decreased protein digestion and decreased mineral absorption. It loses the ability to do the enzymes. Chronic intestinal permeability. And because of this slowed down movement, things are staying there, things are aggravating and irritating more, and we can get leaky gut as a result of a vagus nerve imbalance. And depression. This can all lead to depression because of the lack of the communication. The communication back up to the brain isn't what it's supposed to be. The serotonin and the dopamine are affected. So on the side of what causes it, anybody want to guess at some of the things that cause the vagus nerve to go out of balance? GMOs, yeah, toxins, GMOs, things like that, sure. What else? A malalignment can be a problem, right? Because of it comes through the cervical and the sacral area, yeah. Hiatal hernia, which is where the stomach starts to go up and slip up, and oftentimes that's as a result of a softened lower esophageal sphincter, which is affected by HCL. Muscular imbalances, and that goes to the vertebral misalignments as well. Alcohol can affect it. Spicy foods. Now, don't, you know, feel like you don't want to eat spicy foods, but somebody who's having an issue, the spicy foods can actually lower the effect of that. It could actually be overstimulating for some folks. Stress, fatigue, and anxiety. So all of those things play in. So when you're doing a history with people, you want to find out if these things are happening for them and if their vagus nerve, if they have symptoms that you think, the vagus nerve might be involved. And we're going to teach you how to actually do it, to stimulate it. But first, we're going to look at the gut microbiome and how the vagus nerve affects it. So we have organisms in the gut. They can stimulate or activate the vagus nerve, and they have a critical role in mediating the effects on the brain and behavior. Because the gut microbiome affects the vagus nerve. They communicate. Dr. O'Brien talked about that earlier as well. The vagus nerves can differentiate between pathogenic and non-pathogenic. Good thing, right? What if you have an underactive vagus nerve? You're not going to activate the immune system to get rid of the pathogenic bacteria, and you end up with overgrowth. And then finally, signals from the gut can stimulate the immune system. So we have, through the vagus nerve, there's like problems in the gut. It's like, help, there's something going on here. Stimulates the vagus nerve, which goes to the brain. And the brain, this is, I think we need the immune system to get involved here. So all the feedback that's coming from the microbiome through the vagus nerve is affecting how the body's functioning. So we'll do another chart. I promise we won't get too detailed here. But I really like this chart, because it shows you the interactions between the various parts of the nervous system and the effects. So we have up at the top is the frontal cortex. Remember, we talked about that's the brainy part. That's the high-level thinking part. That can excite the vagus nerve to stimulate digestion. It's like, we're going to eat. We have to eat now. That affects this thing called the insular cortex, which actually has a map. It contains a map of the viscera. And that then stimulates the vagus nerve. Both of those do. And then the vagus nerve will activate the migrating motor complex, activates the motility in the gut, helps with the digestion, helps with the enzymes, helps with the stimulate the absorption. And then that talks to the enteric nervous system. So then it says, okay, it's time to go. So it gets the signal we want to have movement down there. It stimulates the enteric nervous system to contract and relax, contract and relax, contract and relax. So this is a little bit more about the enteric nervous system, also called the second brain. It's basically the neurons and the connections from the gut up to the brain. So what do we have? This isn't new. People think, this whole concept of the gut brain, the second brain, if you look around, it's not new. It was first talked about in 1907 by people in U.S., a U.S. doctor, and also a British physiologist. And they talked about it, and they called it this enteric nervous system. There are 100 million neurons in the enteric nervous system. That's more than in the spinal column. And we think about the spinal column as being, that's master, there's so many neurons. There's more in the enteric nervous system than there are in the spinal column. What else? 90% of the signals go from the gut up to the brain versus down from the brain to the gut, right? And then, there we go. Yours has it all on one page, and so does mine, but I thought it was hard to read, so I separated it for the slide. We talked about this a little earlier. The pathogens from the gut stimulate along the vagus nerve to say, hey, danger down here, hey, danger down here. What are we going to do about this? And it stimulates the brain to then initiate an immune response. We've got, Dr. Tom talked about this a little bit earlier. He called them endotoxins, right? So these bacteria produce, a gram-negative bacteria, they produce these endotoxins, and these endotoxins can damage the lining. Well, there's one in particular, well, it's also called lipopolysaccharides, that are produced. And these lipopolysaccharides can bore holes in the intestinal lining. And what happens when they do that is then they penetrate and they get into the bloodstream. So there's ways to measure that. And there is an intestinal barrier function test that Cyrex Labs does. And it basically measures, is there lipopolysaccharide? Are there antibodies to it in the blood? Which means, oops, it's leaky gut, because those lipopolysaccharides, instead of being flushed out, have entered the bloodstream. And we'll talk about that test tomorrow. There's a few other things. And that's one of our raffle prizes, by the way. That intestinal permeability test is one of our raffle prizes, and also the brain barrier function test is one of the raffle prizes. So be back on time for breaks. Okay. And there's some research, and I gave you the research papers, the neuroscience, gastroenterology, and liver physiology published stimulation of the vagus nerve is found to be effective in chronic non-responsive depression. Now, is that good news or what for people with this depression that's not responding? And we're going to teach you how to stimulate the vagus nerve. Anybody want to have some fun and learn how to stimulate the vagus nerve? Okay. All right. Let's go to the next. Ooh, what happened? There we go. All right. So this is basically the way the signaling works. And this is just like a kind of a summary of everything we've been talking about. You've got changes in your microbiota, which can cause leaky gut by one of the processes we just talked about with those endotoxins and the lipopolysaccharides. And then we have the production of cytokines, which are immune chemicals that produce inflammation to try to send support to that area, which those cytokines then damage the blood-brain barrier in the gut, and we'll talk more about that in detail tomorrow in the brain. And then that causes alterations in your neurotransmitter levels, which cause change in the synaptic activity. And the synaptic activity is the gaps between the neurons and how they communicate one to the other. That's where neurotransmitters have their action. You have one nerve, and then it spits out a neurotransmitter, and that stimulates the next nerve in sequence, and then that fires along, and the signals are sent via these neurotransmitters. The gaps between are synapses. So synaptic activity refers to the way that these things are altered. We have then that causes what? Behavioral changes, changes in the brain, which then stimulates emotional eating, dietary indiscretions, which starts the whole thing over again, which causes more microbiota change. So it's a vicious cycle that we want to break. Okay? And teaching foundations, teaching the whole way that all of this, you know, the diet, the lifestyle, the movement, and all that is critical. So I know it's really great to learn all these great things and learn the herbs, and we'll talk about lots of herbs on Sunday and learn the nutrients, but you've got to really work with people on a gut level. A lot of people will come to me on, say, support calls, and they say, oh, I have a patient, and they're doing this and that and the other thing, and this is what's happening. And I'll say, okay, what should I do? Like, okay, what are they eating? Well, kind of standard American diet. I said, start there. That's where you start. Like, work with them on the food. And someone asked earlier, well, what do I do if they won't? Like, when you asked about that about your child, the mother said to Phyllis, she said, we're not going to do any, I promised my child we wouldn't do any special diets. Kid has ADD, so you just have to help me somehow, right? And I don't want to do drugs either. And I was like, you don't have tools beyond that. Well, you could, now you do. You have your magic wand. There you go. Case closed, right? There you go, Right? That's what they want sometimes. I remember one of my first patients after I graduated, I was in practice, I was all excited, and she had cardiovascular disease, she had all this stuff, and I'm like, I talked to her about all this great stuff she could do diet-wise. Well, I can't do the diet. Well, we can start off and slowly ease into dietary stuff, but then you're missing this and this, and you're taking this drug, which means you're missing these nutrients. Well, I don't want to take all that stuff. Don't you have like just one thing I could take? And I'm like, no, I didn't have my magic wand back then. So I said, I really don't think I can help you. Because if you're not willing to do the diet, you're not willing to do the lifestyle, and you're not willing to take the supplements, I don't have a magic bullet. Who has a magic bullet here? You want to share? You do? The one that what? The Nutribullet. Oh. Thank you. Good one. Good one. The magic bullet, right? Yeah, you can get, and if you get them to make smoothies, sometimes that is magic, right? Right. That is kind of, you know, you get to, okay, just let's do this. Let's just throw a bunch of veggies in the blender. I know you don't like to eat them. We'll throw a bunch of veggies in the blender, and then we're going to put in some kind. What spices do you like? You know, put them all in the blender. Anyway, that's that. So we're going to have a little quiz, and then we're going to go and look at how to stimulate the rest of the vagus nerve. So we have the impaired gut motility, leads to yeast overgrowth, can cause constipation, liver stress. We have decreased ileocecal valve function because that's contractility, right? So if the ileocecal valve gets stuck and it's open, we get a backflow of all those bacteria that are supposed to be in the large intestine and they go into the small intestine. That's one of the causes of SIBO. So I'm going to have this, there's a blank here, and you're going to write in that little blank if you can. So what does decreased gallbladder contraction cause? Lower levels of bile, and then what does lower levels of bile cause? Decreased fat absorption. Now, what else can decreased gallbladder contraction cause? What happens if the gallbladder isn't releasing it? I heard it. Stones, right? Because all that bile is staying in the gallbladder and it gets sludged up and then it can cause stones. So it's not real safe to do that. So what about decreased HCl? What does that cause? Loss of protein digestion. What else? What's that? Minerals are not digested. Absolutely. Absolutely. And what about, what's one other thing if we have low HCl that it can cause? H. pylori could be, yeah, what else? Reflux, acid reflux. You guys are good. All right, so what does decreased bile? We already talked about that. And reduced blood flow to the intestines can cause leaky gut because we don't have the ability to heal it. So all of these things can happen by problems with the vagus nerve not being affected, not being proper. So when we look at the gut imbalances and what brain symptoms they can lead to, we have flora disruption, we have I put the answers in. There we go, I forgot I did that. There we go, you got your answers in there. I'll give you a second to write them down in that tiny little space. Pretty good. Okay. So we're going to look at gut imbalances, brain symptoms. So we have disruption of the flora. We have the lipopolysaccharides. We have cytokines that are produced, which are inflammatory chemicals. We have imbalances in the gut peptides. Remember we talked about some of those peptides that, you know, gastric inhibiting peptide, etc. Well, what happens on the brain side? Well, all of that disruption in the gut can be the cause of their depression and anxiety. It can cause changes in appetite, usually not for the better, but sometimes it is loss of appetite, and then you have people who waste away and don't eat. It can cause damage to the receptors It can cause blood-brain barrier damage, and we'll go into that in detail tomorrow. And changes in the neurochemistry, changes in all of those neurochemicals that are so important for proper brain function. All right, so what's next? Let's look at a couple more things. We talked about ghrelin. Actually, we didn't talk about ghrelin. We'll talk about ghrelin now. We did talk about ghrelin earlier, right? We said ghrelin was that hormone that gets produced in the stomach when you're hungry. But they found some interesting things with ghrelin. Well, stress leads to increased ghrelin. So who's ever had that situation where you're stressed out and you're hungry? You're like, you can't get satisfied, right? That's ghrelin increases. Ghrelin also stimulates dopamine. And dopamine is good in the right amounts. But excess dopamine can be addicting almost, right? We just like, oh, I like that feeling. Oh, let me eat more. Let me do some things to stimulate the dopamine. You know, well, we smoke some pot. Pot is good for dopamine. So what they found, and this was a study in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, that said that chronic stress or depression can lead to chronically elevated ghrelin, which can cause obesity. Like you're always hungry, never stops. And I'm sure you have some clients like that, where they don't get satisfied. So two more, and then we'll go into stimulating it. Just briefly, Dr. Tom talked about Parkinson's and Alzheimer's with relationship to the microflora, right? Well, there's an investigator named Hilo Brake at the University of Frankfurt. I'm not sure if I said that right. Anybody who's German can help me pronounce that. He said that he believes that all the Parkinson's begins in the gut. And Dr. Karazian talks a lot about constipation possibly being an early sign of Parkinson's. Okay, but the constipation can be related to what? The vagus nerve being inhibited. So Parkinson's might be something that if you can get people to change their diet, shift their microbiome, stimulate their vagus nerve, that may prevent the Parkinson's. And then on top of it, you've got gluten. And he didn't talk a whole lot about that, but gluten has been shown in a lot of studies to give early Parkinson's, as he said. He did talk about it. I missed it. And then Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is, there's some things called neurofibrillary tangles in the brain. When they look at the classic look of what Alzheimer's looks like, they're finding those in the gut as well. And again, they've seen Alzheimer's connected to gluten as well and low particular fats. So fat digestion, MCT, medium chain triglycerides, which are found in things like coconut oil and also palm oil. And that really helps with Alzheimer's to help prevent some of those neurodegenerative changes. So, but it's just really, it's scary, but it's also really freeing to know that a lot of these things that we think are incurable brain and neuron diseases can actually be helped with the gut. And if we go back to, we'll introduce it again tomorrow, that pyramid, and you have it in your chart, gut. Let's start with the gut. If their gut's working fine, great, but you got to start and make sure that the gut is really clean. They've got good microbiome. And then finally, how are we going to stimulate? Does anybody want to come up and volunteer to demonstrate some of these things, these ways of? Okay, come on up. So we're going to look at the vagus nerve activation. And gargling is something that can help activate the vagus nerve. So if you've got somebody, before they eat, have them gargle. Just water is fine. So we're going to get your vagus nerve working because it's, what time is it almost? Dinner time, right? So Beverly, you know what else I need? Do we have an empty glass? Can somebody bring me over an empty glass from over there so she can, you can swallow it if you want to, but you can spit into it if you do too. Okay. It's clean. You just don't drink it. Yeah. Okay. So demonstrate gargling. She's going to activate her vagus. Now do it for long, like 15 to 30 seconds. Yeah. Who's ever gargled in public? She's going to digest her food really well, isn't she? Okay, go for it. That's okay. That's good. But do that before, yay, along with your pre-meal. Breathing and appreciation, you gargle, right? You do it pretty quickly. Yeah, it does it pretty quickly. I don't know. I've not looked at, you know, I think both is good.
Yeah, of course.
Both is better. Thank you. Okay, who wants the next one? Who wants to do their gag reflex? Forcefully. Okay, that's a good point. It's like really forceful gargling. I'll see if I can demonstrate it. It's a good workout. Yeah, so do it forcefully. Good. Yes, thank you. So I said, do it until you tear up. She read in Dr. Karazian's book. So you do it until you tear up. And you'll go longer and longer each time. So, and it takes a little bit of time. And sometimes you might feel like, oh, you know what I mean? Like the digestive juices start to flow. The other one is the gag. And basically, I'll demonstrate it. You can use a tongue depressor. You can use the end of a spoon. But you're basically, or you can stick your finger in your mouth. There you go. Spoon, downside. I don't know. I have to look that one up. I'm not sure how many times. Till you tear. It's till you tear. You do it till you tear. Some of the other things are singing. So let's all sing. What should we sing? Loud. Singing loud. So if you're in a concert or you're, you know, happy, play a song. Play us a song and we'll sing to it. No, is we're not there? Then the gap, yeah. And you don't have to do all of them. You can, you know, pick one that you like, but find one. It should be, yeah. What do we want to sing? Row, row, row your boat. Okay? 1, 2, 3. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. On the webcast, you should be doing it too. Okay, before your meal, so your family will think you're nuts. First you're gagging yourself, then you're gargling, then you're singing, then you're going, then you're eating, and they're like, okay, you can be healthy, I'm done. Just give me the food. Yeah. Anyway, so I think that was it for today.